Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome the radio and online audiences, as well as our audience here in San Francisco. It's my pleasure to introduce C.W. Gortner, the author of The Queen's Vow and several other books on historical fiction. And, of course, The Queen's Vow is about Isabel of Castile and the financier for Columbus's voyages. Mr. Gortner.
I'm awful about turning off my phone. There we go. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate seeing you here. I don't know who's in the other room, but evidently he's drawing quite a crowd. So here's my book. I'll put it up here so you can see it. So this is my third standalone historical with Random House. I also have a Tudor thriller series with St. Martin's Press. And I write novels about powerful women in history, controversial women in history usually. I'm usually attracted to women that have a dark legend attached to them or some sort of contradiction or duality in their personality. And Isabel of Castile has always been a character that has fascinated me, mainly because I was raised in Spain. I'm half Spanish by birth. I was raised in Malaga. And there was a ruined castle right by where I lived that I used to go scramble in. And later on when I got a little older, I rode my horse through it. Recently, when I went back to visit this town that I had been raised in that I hadn't been back in almost 10 years, the castle's been fully restored. It's nothing like it was. But it used to belong to Isabella and Ferdinand. It was one of their summer residences after they had conquered the south. Malaga, which was a city that was nearby where I lived, was the site of one of Isabella's biggest victories in her war against the Moors and also a site of a near assassination attempt on her life. So she was somebody that I grew up with and was almost like a real person to me. My school would go to Granada every year, and we'd go to the cathedral. So I grew up seeing her tomb. Her and Fernando are buried together in the Cathedral of Granada, and her daughter, Juana, and Juana's husband, Philip, are buried right next to them in this mausoleum. My first novel, The Last Queen, is about Juana. And in that novel, you meet Isabella when she's already the older established queen. So the queen that's sent Columbus to America, she's united Spain, she's already a dynastic queen, she's focused on moving her family forward. She's sort of put Spain onto the world stage at this point. And part of my interest in writing The Queen's Vow was to go back and take a look at who was she before she became that queen? How did she become that particular person? How did she become the woman that she became? The research for The Last Queen, I did a lot of focus on Isabella's reign. And, of course, I read about her previous life to becoming a queen, but I hadn't really focused on it. So when I began to research this book, I was really astonished to discover all kinds of interesting things about her, unexpected things about Isabella. It's interesting to note that she's probably one of the most famous queens in history after Elizabeth I. I mean, we all sort of know something about her. I mean, when you bring up her name, most people will say, oh, she sent Columbus to America, or Isabella and Ferdinand, you put her together. It's almost like it's one unit, like Brangelina. But she's always very familiar to that. But what's interesting is that we don't know anything about her youth. Most Western audiences don't know anything about how she became queen. Most of us don't know anything. And a lot of Spaniards don't either. When I was growing up in Spain and going to school, Isabella was taught to us as the queen. You know, we got her history from the time she becomes queen, and we got very specific incidents about her life. And, of course, she's known as well for the Inquisition, the establishment of the Spanish Inquisition. So she has this yin and yang, this dark and this white side to her that's always interesting for me to work with. So I'm going to talk a little bit about setting the stage for what Spain is like before Isabella comes to the throne, because the Spain that Isabella inherits is very different from the Spain we know today, or the Spain that she leaves when she dies. When Isabella comes to the throne, Spain is still a divided realm. There's Aragon in the north, which is a smaller, more vulnerable kingdom. They own Sicilies. They have cousins in Naples. But basically, it is a vulnerable kingdom that's often invaded by France. Then there's a lot of territorial issues with France. Castile and León have by this point been united, so the majority of the middle of Spain is one kingdom. But it's a very fractious kingdom. There's a lot of rapacious nobles, and there's been a lot of ineffective and weakling kings before Isabella. So basically, you're looking at a kingdom where literacy was at its lowest rate, 10% in the population. Nobles were proud that they had never read a book. It was all about war. It was all about what you had. So there was a lot of challenging of the king. The standing army had been left to sort of crumble into disarray. So you have very strong nobility holding vast swaths of land and basically building castles wherever they want. And so you still almost have like a feudal system of government going on at a time when many other kingdoms, including France and partially in England, you're starting to see solidification under one crown and under one rule. You're starting to lose this sort of warlord mentality amongst your nobility. But the Castile that we're looking at still has very much this in play, despite having a long tradition of having a king. Isabella, is not ever destined to be a queen. She's not destined for greatness. Nobody really thought that she would get to be a queen. She's the daughter of a second marriage. Her father married a Portuguese princess as his second wife. He dies. The wife is sent into basically what they call exile, but she was sent into the country. The widowed queen did not stay at court. What's unique about Isabella's position is that her mother managed to negotiate to bring her children with her. So Isabella and her younger half-brother, her younger brother, go to the country with her. She's raised in a little castle near Avila. I don't know if anybody has been to Spain here, but Avila is a province in the center, towards the center of Castile. It's very flat. It's very arid. If you go there, it's baked in the summer. It's very cold in the winter. And she's raised with a very, insular existence. There's an animal fair at Medina del Campo nearby that they probably attended every year. But this is a girl that's raised very rurally, in a very rural environment. She probably learned to card wool. They had animals that lived inside the castle precincts that they needed to tend to. They prepared everything there. They probably had merchants that came by now and then that brought news from the outside world, but she probably knew very little outside of her existence. And she's educated in a convent that she probably traveled to. She knew how to read and write, but this is a very rudimentary education for what we'd expect a princess to have. And when you compare her, for example, her educational schedule to the educational schedule that we later see Elizabeth I get, and Elizabeth is another queen that we never thought would be queen. You know, there were people ahead of her in line. She had an exemplary Renaissance education. I mean, her educational schedule is astonishing, even to us, to modern day. I mean, it's at the level of a university person when she's 15 years old. But Isabella has none of this. So no one's really expecting her to do anything. She's probably just going to be used for an alliance at some point. And what happens to Isabella is that her half-brother is sitting on the throne, from the first marriage, her father's first marriage, and he suddenly awakens one day and decides that he wants to see his half-brother and sister at court. And Isabella at this point is probably about 11 years old, and her brother's a little younger, and they bring them to court, and she becomes involved in a dynastic struggle between a group of nobles that want to change the rule of the kingdom and depose the current king, and her half-brother, who's sitting on the throne and is married to another Portuguese princess, who has a daughter that she's promoting into the succession that no one is sure whether that daughter is actually a child of the king's or not. This is a pretty lascivious court that she's brought to. It's a court that has a lot of intrigue. Her half-brother, Enrique IV, or Henry, is a fascinating character in his own right. He wore Moorish garb a lot. He liked to wear turbans. He kept wild animals in the Alcázar. If anybody's been to the Alcázar de Segovia, it's that beautiful old sort of fairy tale castle that sits on a cliff over Segovia. He kept a whole menagerie of animals there. He loved animals. He wasn't a big hunter. He's very unique and interesting in his own right, but he's nothing like what nobles would expect a king to be. This is a very gentle man. There's a lot of evidence of support that he was probably either bisexual or gay. He had a lot of lovers and attendants with him. So, of course, in those days, the nobility is like, this guy can't rule. So we're going to get rid of him, and we're going to put Isabella's little half-brother on the throne. So she becomes involved in this dynastic struggle and is held captive at this Alcázar for a while under the queen while her half-brother escapes and leads a civil war. And all of a sudden, she's thrust into importance. She's suddenly thrust into a position when people are starting to look at her and starting to pay attention to her. Bear in mind that at this point, she's 14 years old, and she's learning to navigate a world that she's never been prepared to navigate. She's learning to navigate intrigues and corruption and betrayals that she's never seen before. And somehow she survives all of this and is able to find her way into a position of somewhat neutrality, and by placating her half-brother kind of preserves herself from being imprisoned or married off, which was what a lot of negotiations were going on, was to marry her off. This brings us to Fernando, because how he comes into her life is really important. He's a prince of Aragon, and he's also very much like Isabella. He's the son of a second marriage. No one expected him to inherit. He has an older half-brother. Rumor is that his mother, who was the daughter of a Castilian noble family, poisoned his half-brother to pave the way for Fernando's succession. There's no proof of that. But the Enriquez family, who his mother was descended from, they were known for doing all kinds of fun stuff like that, so wouldn't have been beyond them. He comes into the picture, and he suddenly rises to the fore as becoming the heir of Aragon. And there had been a previous, earlier on during Isabella's youth, extreme youth, when she was still a baby, there was talk of betrothal with Fernando. So their names have already been linked. But through the years, this has sort of not worked. This is very common in royal marriage markets. Oftentimes, when a child was born, within days, even before baptism, an alliance is being negotiated for that child. How often that actually comes to pass, it doesn't often come to pass. It's often changed. So no one really thought that this marriage was going to happen, and certainly Fernando and Isabella probably didn't think about it at the time. However, it does happen, and it happens through a series of machinations. I don't want to give away the book, so I'm going to try to jump around a little bit. But it does happen, and it's actually a forbidden marriage, because by the time Isabella becomes the heiress to the throne, which she does become, she's thrust into importance upon the death of her half-brother. She suddenly becomes the heiress to the throne. She's 18 years old. They forbid her marriage to Fernando. And mainly the big fear that her half-brother, King Enrique, had was if she married this young prince of Aragon, they would unite Castile and Aragon under one banner. And it would be more of a challenge to him as a king. And already he's dealing with a handful, because all of a sudden Isabella is starting to show a lot of backbone and a lot of sort of courage. But she's not acting the way a princess is supposed to act. There have been several alliances that they've tried to negotiate for her. She's refused them. She said she won't marry this particular prince or that particular prince. And she sort of insisted that the person she has to marry is Fernando. And it's kind of an interesting... It feels very romantic, and there may have been a level of romantic inclination there, but what we really start to see is a woman who's thinking ahead, who's looking to the good of her country and the future, and she's realizing that she needs to marry within Spain. No foreign prince would have been accepted in Spain at that time. For much of Spain's history, it's been a very insular country, and Spaniards have been very insular in the regards to foreign rulers. We'll see this later when Juana, Isabella's daughter Juana, marries a Burgundian prince and they inherit the throne, how much he was detested. The word flamenco comes from a derogatory term that they used against him as a Habsburg for being a Fleming. So Isabella already knows that in order to inherit the throne, she has to marry within the country. And who better than this prince, who's about 2 years younger than her, or a year younger than her. They are second cousins, but in those days, there's papal dispensations. These things get done. The marriage is forbidden. They negotiated it anyway under the table, and Fernando has this perilous trek from Aragon into Castile to marry her. Legend is they never saw each other physically until the night before their marriage. So that's what the story says. In my novel, I predate their meeting a little bit because it's hard to establish characters at that point. And there's no evidence to suggest they didn't meet and no one recorded it because they just didn't think it was important. But the first meeting that's recorded between the two of them is the night before their marriage. What makes their marriage so interesting is that it's not only a political alliance that works for them, it also ends up being a love match. These were two people that seemed very uniquely suited for one another. And it goes on to become one of the most successful marriages in history, as we know, despite the fact that he had a bit of a roving eye. Some of the things that I found really fascinating about Isabella is that because of her lack of a formal education, once she becomes queen, she faces a country that is on the verge of collapse. It's basically bankrupt. There's a lot of nobility with a lot of castles and a lot of retainers that are going to challenge her right. You have the Moors that are still banked in the south. Now, at this point, there's a lot of misconceptions about the Moors and Spain and what Isabella did with the Moors. By the time Isabella comes to the throne, the Moors hold a small southern portion of Spain. They hold the kingdom of Granada. They're no longer in Sevilla. They're not in Córdoba. They've been pushed way back. They're also a fractured kingdom themselves at this point. There's a lot of infighting amongst them. There's two brothers that are vying for control of Granada. This is a kingdom that's already on the verge of collapse. The golden age that we associate with the medieval years in Spain of tolerance, when everybody lived together, when the Moors held most of the south, it's long over. You know, we're dealing with a much more sort of the end of that. So, but she still knows they're there, and it's within every Christian king's privilege, and it's also a requirement of all these Christian kings of Spain, that you have to initiate the reconquest. You have to go and kick the Moors out. And Isabella's ancestors have all pushed them back, but not completely. So she knows in the back of her head that that's coming, but she's also got to put the kingdom together. What she accomplishes is really astonishing. She revalues all the coinage. She eliminates, there were 250 mints producing coinage in Castile when she comes to the throne. She eliminates them to 25. So she gets rid of the debased coinage. She sets up with Fernando a series of partidas, they're called, which are actually the basis of administrative law in Castile that is still held on to today. What Isabel and Fernando start is the basis of administrative law in Spain today. I've lived in Spain. There's good and bad points about that. But there you have it. She completely recodifies law. She was very forward-thinking around women's education. Our image of Isabella, I know a lot of us have images, I'm assuming. I've spoken to a lot of people since this book has come out, and I'm always surprised to hear what people think of when they think of her. They sort of think of a woman in dark with a big crucifix, with a wet doily on her head, being very somber, no sense of humor. She actually wasn't like that. She actually was someone who was quite bright. She loved bright clothes. She had very little personal vanity, but she loved jewelry. She's known for being famous for her love of jewelry, which she pawned pretty consistently to fund her wars. So this one necklace that Fernando gave her, the tabled rubies of Aragon, I counted, it went into hawk four different times during her reign so that she could pay for her wars. But she was somebody who liked to dress up. She was short, blonde, blue-eyed, white-skinned, probably attractive. Not what we think of when we think of Isabella. And she had forward-thinking notions about women's education. At this time in Europe, women cannot go into any universities except in Salerno in Italy. Women are not allowed to enter any universities. They're not allowed to get degrees. Isabella issued the first decree that allowed women to begin studying in universities and not only study and get degrees, but lecture. So, for example, Beatriz Galindo, who's known as La Latina, who became a very famous lecturer at the University of Salamanca, she tutored the queen in Latin. So at age 30, 30, 32, in the midst of everything else Isabella was doing, she sat down and taught herself Latin because she had so deplored her lack of education. And Latin in those days was the language of diplomacy. You needed to speak Latin in order to communicate with ambassadors. And she hated the fact that she couldn't, and she had to rely on translators. So she taught herself Latin. She also hired Beatriz to teach her daughters. So each of her daughters received such an exemplary education that by the time she sets out to marry her daughters, these are the most coveted brides in Europe. They're known as the most well-educated princesses in Europe. And it's always fascinating to remember that Catherine of Aragon, who's Henry VIII's first wife, is Isabella's youngest child. And I saw a letter from Catherine that she wrote to her mother shortly before, after she arrived in England to marry Arthur, who's Henry's youngest, older brother. And the letter is a marvelous letter because it's the letter of a homesick child, astonished at how cold and damp everything is, how dirty everything is. She makes comments about how dirty everything is, and how women don't read. And they don't know why she has all these books with her. So Isabella was very forward-thinking in this process and put together... you know, a package for her daughters of brides. She was also unlike most royal women in that she raised her children herself. Isabella's daughters were not sent to noble households to be educated. It was very customary at this time, if you were a queen, that you did not raise your own children. You often, almost never even breastfed your own children. It was considered déclassé. You had a robust peasant nursemaid who came and did it for you, and you placed your daughters in households of nobles who would raise them for you. Isabella refused to place her children in any other household. She raised them with them. She brought them on crusade with her. Her children grew up in the grit of war. Sitting on the Vega outside Granada, when they were conquering Granada, a Moor shot an arrow into the encampment that burned it to the ground. Her daughters were sleeping at the time. She had to run in and grab all her children and get them out for safety. So her daughters were raised. It was a nucleus. It was a domestic nucleus, which was very unique for this period of time. The other thing that is really interesting about her is that she imported the first printing press in Spain. And because of that, she raised literacy. So by the end of her, she reigned for 30 years. She died young. She was 53. Probably, they speculate, probably of ovarian cancer. We don't know. But she brought in this first printing press, and by the time she died, literacy in Spain had raised 40%. And she used to chastise nobles at court in front of other nobles, which, of course, was the best way to get everybody to pay attention and do what she wanted, by saying, "Did you read that book I sent you?" Which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The very first book to ever be printed in Spain was a book of Psalms, and it was given to Isabella as a gift. The second book that was printed was a little book of hymns, which she then had distributed throughout all of the different parishes. By the time she died, almost every major city in Spain had a printing press. She was very interested in what was going on in Italy in the Renaissance and what Italy was importing and what was coming in, and she actively moved to bring that into the country. So those are the good things about her. Some of the stuff that's not so good, I'm just checking my time to make sure I'm going okay. We know about the Inquisition, and I'm going to just talk a little bit about it, and then I'll take some questions. But when I looked into the Inquisition, when I wrote this book, the first thing my editor said when I said, I want to do Isabella. I want to do it up to when Columbus goes to America. I want to kind of back my next book into The Last Queen. And in between, I had written a book on Catherine de' Medici. And my editor, the first words that came out of her mouth was, "What are you going to do about the Inquisition?" Because, you know, they want sympathetic heroines. They want women that we can all relate to. And some of the problems that I see a lot in historical fiction these days is everybody sort of wants Laura Croft in a big gown. And unfortunately, as much as we want to modernize these women and turn them into women that we can all relate to, feminism doesn't exist at this time. Women don't think the way feminist women think. Isabella is a very interesting dichotomy in that way. She's very forward-thinking about women's education, but she was very much traditional in her approach to her family life and to her devotion to her husband. I mean, he fooled around, and she knew it. And she would watch, and when things started to cool off, she'd pack the lady off with a marriage and a dowry off to some place. So this is very typical of what Isabella did, and it's hard for us to reconcile those things. The same thing with the Inquisition. It's hard to reconcile that a woman that did some of the accomplishments I've just mentioned could have set the Inquisition into motion. But Isabella was a woman, like many people of her time, who believed in the salvation of the soul. She believed that the soul lived on. There was a purgatory. You did go to heaven or hell, depending on what you did. And she believed in a vengeful and retributive God who would attack you personally for not doing what he wanted. And if you were God's anointed queen, you were doubly on the line. So the spotlight was on you. So with that in mind, Isabella is facing a lot of corruption within her church when she comes to the throne. The Spanish church has become an amalgam of religions. You have many people living on this peninsula for many, many centuries. Jews, Moors, Christians, they're all living together. And after a while, the religions start to blend. So you have priests who really don't think anything of giving communion on Sunday, hanging a menorah on their wall, and listening to the Quran being chanted. It's just something they accept. So Spain has this hybrid religion that's going on. So when Isabella starts to hear about this, and she's hearing about this from somebody that we've probably all heard from, Torquemada. Most of you have heard about Torquemada? Yeah, who hasn't? He's the Grand Inquisitor. So he's sort of like the evil genius of the story. He was sort of the architect of the Spanish Inquisition. He's the one who put it into motion. He's the one who sort of led it for many years until his death. And he's sort of like the dark genius whispering in Isabella's ear. She met him when she was very young in Segovia. He was the prior of a monastery there. And it was during some of her darkest days when she was struggling to elude her half-brother's intrigues. And he gave her a lot of advice. And he became somebody that she relied upon, but also sort of shunned a little bit. There's nothing nice about this guy. He's not a nice person. He's a fanatic. He also physically was kind of repellent. He went barefoot a lot, even in the winter. And if you've been in Castile in the winter, it snows. It's not pretty. He didn't bathe a lot. I mean, there's nothing about the guy you like. But she, you know, heeded some of his advice, and he was banging this drum about the church being corrupted. So Isabella requested an ecumenical council to investigate the state of the churches, and she spent 4 years trying to figure out what was going on. She had a papal bull that was authorized to sanction the Inquisition that Torquemada was insisting she develop. She held off for 4 years before she put that into action. So when she made the decision to turn the Inquisition into an actual fact, she did it with a lot of reluctance and a lot of hesitation as to what it would bring about. And unfortunately, as we know from history, what she unleashed was something she could no longer control. But it's hard to judge the actions of somebody who lived 600 years in the past from what we know today. In hindsight, what she did was very wrong. And we think there could have been many other ways for her to handle it. But if you go into her time and you look at it from her world, the Inquisition is kind of inevitable. It's sort of part of what she needs to do to bring Spain to power. So I think I've hit my 30 mark, and I'm wondering if you guys have questions. Anybody have questions for me? Or? Oh, great. Good. I love questions. Okay.
I'd like to remind everybody that we're listening to C.W. Gortner, the author of The Queen's Vow about Isabella of Castile at the Commonwealth Club in California in San Francisco. And it's time to take questions. Who would like to ask?
Was the Inquisition instituted as a means of cleaning up corruption mostly?
It originally was intended to clean up corruption and target one specific population, a population called the conversos, which were Jews that had converted to Christianity. In previous sort of mass conversions that happened in the 13th century, there was a massive conversion in the 13th century. There was rumored that they were not actually, they were practicing Judaism. They were either outwardly pretending to be Christian but practicing Judaism in secret, or they actually weren't even practicing Christianity at all. And it was to investigate that particular population. Openly Jewish people were not targeted by the Inquisition. They were expelled by the Edict of 1492. So that did happen, but they were not targeted by the Inquisition, not during Isabella's reign.
What was her rationale for expelling them?
For expelling the Jews. That it's complicated. Again, it's complicated, so I'll try to make it as streamlined as possible. None of these decisions are taken in a vacuum. Basically, by the time Granada is conquered and the Inquisition is moving to investigate the conversos, and there have already been burnings. There's already Torquemada's already taken the bull by the horns. This sort of simmering cauldron of anti-Semitism that existed in Europe is erupting in Spain. And so you're seeing a lot of spontaneous demonstrations against Jews in various cities around this time. Isabella is very focused in the south, and in Castile she's getting reports that Jews are being attacked in the ghettos, that there was one particularly very violent attack where 700 people were killed. So she becomes increasingly concerned about the way people are reacting to her unification policy about one faith. And secondly, she begins to realize that the only way that she can get one faith in this country, it has to be one faith, one country, one crown, in order for her to launch her country into world power. She's getting a lot of advice that no one's going to take you seriously on the world stage if you allow the Jews to stay here. No one else has. They've been kicked out of France. They've been kicked out of England. You're the only one harboring them. It becomes sort of this perfect storm of circumstances, coupled with Isabella's own faith and her belief that the Jews are misguided. She wasn't anti-Semitic the way we perceive anti-Semitism. She's not a Nazi. She doesn't want to exterminate. She wants to convert. So her belief was the decree of 1492 would provoke the same level of mass conversions that previous decrees had provoked, like in the 13th century. Her mistake is that it doesn't. We don't know exactly how many Jews left Spain. The numbers are wildly divergent. I've read anywhere between 40,000 and 600,000. It's probably around 20,000, 25,000. but they do leave. It isn't a money grab. There's been a lot of legend about that it was a money grab. It was to fill her coffers because the wars had emptied them. They remained as poor as church mice, and she continued to pawn her jewels until her death. So if it had been a money grab, she would have gotten it. There wasn't that much money to be had. And she did fight to save several personal advisors. Rabbi Senor, who was her treasurer and had been the one who had kept her jewels in various chains, she fought to save him from the decree, and he converted. But conversion was the requirement. Does that sort of answer your question?
Thanks. Can you talk a little bit about how you go about your research?
Right, okay. I read as many primary sources as I can. So I travel. I travel for my books. I know I have friends who are historical novelists who don't. The web has become so widespread that everybody can just click on a picture of Avila and boom, there it goes. But for me, there's nothing that substitutes the actual act of being in a location. I also try to get into different archives to read extant documentation from the period. I'm lucky that I speak Spanish. Old Castilian's really hard to read. So you need to spend some time with these documents because it's hard to interpret. And a lot of stuff isn't translated. But I try to look at correspondence from ambassadors, accounts from the court. Fortunately, Isabella's reign is very well documented. She had a chronologist, Fernando de Pulgar, who wrote a 5-volume history of her reign. The problem with these sources is that you always have to keep in mind in the back of your head, who is writing for them? Who are they addressing? Because everyone's got an agenda. So when you're reading an ambassadorial account, if you're reading a French ambassador's account of what's going on in the Spanish court, you have to keep in the back of your mind, what's he trying to tell his master? What kind of, these are the gossip rags of the Renaissance. This is, you know, this is your Star Weekly. You know, they're trying to send a message from what they're saying. Then I read a lot of secondary sources, and those are biographies, any books I can get on the period, you know, anything I can find on the period that relates to it. My bibliographies can run between 100 and 150 books when all is said and done. So it's a little bit of that. And then I do some psychological and emotional research. I try to look at the people within their period and their era and figure out what did they think like? What did they feel? How did they see their world? I'm always a little concerned that I don't put my perceptions on them. I mean, I love to write about these women, but I don't agree personally with a lot of what they think or see. I'm not a man of the Renaissance. Everyone always asks me, would you like to live there? And I'm like, absolutely not. There's no antibiotics. There's no dry cleaning. Well, what would I do? So that's a little bit about what I do with my research.
In writing about a historical figure like Isabella, why did you write it as a novel and not as a biography?
Because they pay me a lot of money for it. No, I'm just teasing. There's something about historical fiction that I personally find really appealing. I grew up in Spain. I was educated by Jesuits. And so the way I was taught history was with the ruler. You know, it was sort of banged into me. And so I personally had an aversion to history for many years. I didn't really, you know, people would bring it up and it'd be like, ugh. And I fell back in love with history through historical fiction. My mom gave me a novel by Jean Plaidy. And I fell in, it was a book about Anne Boleyn called Murder Most Royal. And I fell in love with history. And all of a sudden, my mom said, you were obsessed. All you wanted to know was about Anne Boleyn and about Isabella, and you were running around wanting to get as many books as you can. So for me, historical fiction is a way to put some flesh and blood on these people and make them real to us again in a way that I think that nonfiction can't. Also, it forces me to take a stand as a writer. With nonfiction, I have the luxury of saying, we don't really know why she did this. You know, this is what she did, but we don't really know. As a novelist, I don't have that luxury. I have to make a decision as to why she did it. So it forces me, as a writer, to challenge myself a little bit. But there's benefits to both, you know?
Can you talk a little bit about the interest with, you know, the discoveries and the Sagres, the Escola de Sagres, and something that has to do with, okay, why did they decide that they needed to conquer another world or another place?
You're talking about the New World, about
the
Columbus.
New World, yeah.
Well, my book ends when Columbus goes to America, because I cover her later years in my first novel. But they didn't decide to conquer a new world. I mean, nobody listened to Columbus. He had been banging around courts for years trying to sell this thing. And Columbus's thing was, I've got a way to circumvent the problems of Istanbul. Because before that, there was a route to the Indies right by Byzantium. But when the Moors conquer Byzantium and shut down that whole passage, Europe is cut off from the spices. The Turks are now owning that whole land. So Columbus is running around saying, I know a way to get around that. And of course, nobody's paying any attention to him. So by the time he hits the Spanish court, he's sort of on his last legs. And he literally was. I mean, he was down to his last penny. He had his child with him. And Isabella was intrigued by his idea, by his proposal. She was a woman, I think, who had vision. She's one of these people that just has vision. She kind of sees things in a different way than most people did. And so she kind of gave him a stipend and told him to hang around because she's like, I'm in the middle of a war here. You know, I'm trying to conquer the Moors. I've got all this stuff going on. When she finally sends him, which is all kind of happens in the same year, 1492, you see the conquest of Granada, the expulsion of the Jews, and she sends Columbus. She didn't know what he was going to find, if he was going to find anything at all. There was no guarantee he was even going to come back. And in fact, most of the court, including Fernando, laughed and snorted and be like, well, that's the last we'll ever see of him. And Fernando in particular was like, that's a whole lot of money we just wasted. But he did. And it's interesting to note that in her last will and testament, Isabella leaves an exhortation to her successors to please treat the native people of the Americas gently. Their words are, lead them gently into Christianity without enslavement. Of course, she's imposing her faith, because that's what she did, and that's what every monarch would do. But she did not want the Americas exploited and destroyed the way they were. What we see under the conquistadors doesn't happen under her. It happens under Charles V. It happens under her grandson. But she probably would have been horrified by the rapine. It wasn't what she intended. And, of course, at the beginning, Columbus doesn't find what you think he's going to find. He doesn't find the gold and the jewels. He brought back two natives and some parrots and some plants. So what we tend to look at history in hindsight and condense everything down into this one little compressed. It's like taking one of those links and then you put it in compression software and it gives you the little itsy link. But in fact, what happens in the New World is years and years in the making. It's horrifying and hard to blame. And a lot of it is laid at her doorstep. But to be fair to her, she never knew. She didn't know what she had set in motion.
Are your books available in e-books?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And in audio and in every way possible.
They're also available in the lab here.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Any other questions?
I know the focus is on Isabella. Obviously, you wrote the book about her, but can you speak at all to how her marriage and her alliance with her husband may have affected the way she reigned?
Well, he's a big part of the book. I mean, he's a huge character in the book. And he's a very big character in the second book, in my book on The Last Queen, about Juana, about their daughter, Juana. He's very much the fire under. Isabella was very cautious. I mean, you see over and over again her caution and her hesitation. She wasn't impulsive. This is a woman who really thought things through. Her experience had taught her to think things through. Also, she comes from a household with a mother who was probably a manic depressive. So Isabella's mother ended up pretty nuts. So she has this horror of erratic behavior, of impulse. Fernando, on the other hand, was very brash. He was a warrior. He tested himself in battle very young. And Castile snorted, you know, they looked down their noses at him. Aragonese were not considered, even, you know, Castilians didn't like them. It's like, oh, the Aragonese. So when she marries him, he's got a lot to prove. Also, she is the major power. Castile was the bigger kingdom. And Isabella is queen of Castile in her own right. Fernando is just king consort. He's not king of Castile. And upon her death, he does not inherit her throne. Their children inherit the throne. So this guy's got a huge chip on his shoulder. Isabella did a lot during their marriage to make sure they looked and were treated as equals. Things that today if we look at, again, it's that feminism again, you know, we might go, well, he just needed to get over himself. And the modern CEO, you know, Glenn Close, would just walk all over him on the way out the door. But Isabella is a woman of her time, and she's horrified that her husband feels this way. So she actually employed a whole team of legal experts to go through Castile's laws and find ways to make him equal. But he lives in her shadow. And yet, he's sort of the spur to her. He also probably was the one that pushed for the Inquisition first. He was interested in it. He wanted it to happen. In Aragon, it was more of a functioning entity than it was in Castile. And he probably most definitely was the one who decided that they were going to go on conquest when they went on conquest. The conquest of Granada happened spontaneously. There was an uprising. It wasn't planned. And when it started happening, Isabella was like, I'm not ready for this. We're broke. You know, I don't want to do this right now. And Fernando was like, no, now's the time. Now we go in and we start it. So he's sort of the fire under her, for good and for bad.
Was Columbus a Catholic?
He has a question too. Was Columbus a Catholic? You know, they say, yeah. I've read all kinds of things about Columbus. Even his birth is questioned. I portray him as a man from Genoa because that seems the most likely. But there's been all kinds of new evidence unearthed that he may not have been from Genoa. There's evidence that suggests that he may have been a hidden Jew. He may have been a converso. I mean, it's hard to know. Outwardly, yes, he was a Catholic, or Isabella would never have listened.
Somebody said that the chief officer.
Probably. There were many Jews serving Isabella. I mean, many Jews serving at court. Rabbi Senor, her Lady Beatriz de Bobadilla, one of her most dear and treasured friends of years who's in the book, was from a family of conversos. Absolutely. It's not what we think. It's not Nazi Germany. It's a different way of looking at religion. And Jews remained at Isabella's court throughout her life.
If you're interested in Columbus, look for a book called Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, that's a great title. I'll have to remember that. I think this gentleman had a question. Oh, I did. Oh, great. Okay.
Do you find it difficult that your readers know what's going to happen in the book?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's always challenging to... With this one, I'm actually feeling a little more it's less of a difficulty because I don't think my readers know. I mean, they know how it ends, but they don't know this particular story. It is challenging when you're writing it, but part of what you do is you try to take a fresh approach to the story and try to make them interesting I try to find a hidden story within the story. So I'm going to try to tell you a story that you think you know and you don't. And that's sort of how I do that. And I did that with Catherine de' Medici. You know, she's got a terrible reputation. She's this reptilian monster in history. And I found a very different woman. So I think that we often think we know something that we don't. And that's sort of what I try to do. But yeah, it's always challenging. When you're writing, you're always keeping in the back of your head, what do you think people know? You know?
Are you ever tempted to change history to make the ending better?
You're always tempted, but you can't. and then there's one over there.
How much, so when you do all your research, I mean, you seem very well researched in the actual history, but then when you write this fictional book, how do you make decisions about, okay, I'm going to embellish this or change this and that kind of thing?
Well, let's take the meeting of Isabel and Fernando, because that's a great meeting. You know, the evidence shows everything that I read from exact documentation to indicate that they don't meet until the day before their marriage, right? Well, and I talked to my editor about that. My editor's like, well, that's not going to work. Because she said, you know, we need to know about him sooner. He needs to be a presence in this novel. So what I did was I decided that they could meet at court when she first comes to court. She comes to court because there's a baptism of her half-brother's new child, who nobody knows if it's really his child or not. And so Isabella was brought to court for that. So that's all real. So I'm like, well, what if Fernando's there representing Aragon? We know somebody from Aragon was there, but we don't know who. The record doesn't indicate who was there. So it could have just as easily have been the prince. It was most likely not the father because his father was very ill at the time with cataracts. His mother was dying of breast cancer. We know that she had breast cancer because they talk about a malady in her breast. So it would have been, it could have been an ambassador, but they mention a member of the royal family there. So I kind of, by digging around, tried to find a place that they could meet. And I'm like, well, here's a great place to meet. There's where I make a decision. Did it happen? I don't know. Is it likely? It's likely. So when I make those decisions to do something that the record doesn't show or it's not clear on, it's always, is it plausible? And if it's plausible, then, I mean, after all, it's a novel. This is entertainment. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not a cure for cancer. But I do try to stay realistic and not turn it into a froth, you know, of conjecture. Oh.
First of all, I just wanted to thank you. This talk has been really, really very interesting, and it's just given me a different side of Isabella beyond what I had ever imagined she would be. I'm curious as to what's next for you. Are there other topics you're researching, other books you're thinking about?
Yeah, my Tudor Thriller series, I have a three-book deal with that with St. Martin's Press, and though that is a fictional character interacting. It's about a young man who becomes a spy to Elizabeth I. And they're more of an adventure series. And I've written the second one on that one, and that one's coming out next year. And now I'm under contract. I'm writing about Lucrezia Borgia. So I'm doing a section of her life again. I'm going to do the Vatican years, and it's great. It's really fun. She's always somebody I've wanted to write about. Again, she's got a horrible reputation. I mean, probably one of the worst. And yet what you find is this really young girl, you know, very young, 13-year-old girl thrust into notoriety when her father becomes pope and is being used in alliances. And she's fascinating, and she's surrounded by these incredible personalities. And as we all know, on Showtime right now, it's all going really gung-ho. And, you know, the shows are great. It's all gauze and nipples. It's wonderful. But the history behind it is what's really fascinating. So I'm writing her right now. So that'll be out probably in 2014.
I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that you're listening to C.W. Gortner, the author of The Queen's Vow about Isabella Castile at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It's part of the great lit series here at the club, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And there's time for several more questions.
Are there any known descendants of Ferdinand and Isabella
in
Spain today?
No. Isabella's daughter, Juana, who I write about in The Last Queen. Everybody knows who Juana is. Juana la Loca. Does anybody, you guys have heard of her? She's also very controversial. She apparently dragged her husband's coffin with her throughout Spain and ended up getting locked up in a castle for 40 years. She's very famous in Spain. She's sort of an emblem of Spain's tragedy. She inherits the throne after Isabella, and things go very bad for her. And she was the person that she's the book that first got me published. And she's the last queen of that Spanish blood to hold it. That's why I call it The Last Queen, because she's the last queen of Isabella's Spanish line to sit on the throne. After that, you get the Habsburgs that come in, because Juana married a Habsburg prince. So you get Charles V and his descendants. That line dies out, and they actually imported a French cadet line of the Bourbons to sit on the Spanish throne to sort of cover it up. But the medieval line dies out, and it dies out with the grandson of Philip II. So you don't have that Spanish bloodline, doesn't exist anymore. Now, Fernando, you know, he got around. So I don't know if there's a little Fernando's running around anywhere. But of that particular royal line, no, it's gone.
Do you read other historical novels about the characters that you write about?
No. I read historical novels. I mean, I love them. I'm kind of addicted to them. And right now, it's a great time because the genres have this huge renaissance, so there's a lot of it out there. You know, some of it's great, some of it's not so great, but I don't read about the people that I write about. It's too easy to absorb another person's perception of the character. I will go back sometimes. With the Catherine de' Medici novel, for example, there was a writer that wrote a novel about her that was published a year before mine, which was a little nerve-wracking for me. It always is in a tough marketplace. But years later, I went back and I read her novel, and it was really great because she did something so completely different from what I had done. But it's rare. And I've been fortunate in that most people don't write about what I write about. I mean, most people are very focused on Tudor England or medieval England, the Plantagenets. Very few of the writers go into Spain or France or Italy. I think it's a little more challenging. It's okay.
I have a question about when Isabel came to court and the period between whatever was 11 years old and 18. Were there any principal characters or individuals who helped to shape her into what she became?
Yeah, there's an archbishop, Archbishop Carrillo, who's a very big portion of the book, the Archbishop of Toledo, who was, you know, these are archbishops, and when we think about churchmen nowadays, when we think about churchmen, we have a very different image. These guys were warriors. I mean, this archbishop, he charged into battle. He wore a breastplate. You know, he carried a sword at court. And he was the Archbishop of Toledo, which was the wealthiest archbishop in Spain. And he took her and her younger half-brother under his wing. He was one of the opponents of her half-brother on the throne. So he did a lot of shaping of her. And when she becomes the heiress of the throne, he continues to be one of her advisors. However, they did clash, and especially when Fernando came in the scene, because then she begins to listen to her husband. And she doesn't want to listen to the archbishop so much. And the archbishop has really got a bee in his bonnet about this young, sort of impudent Aragonese prince who's sort of up in his face and counts all the time. So they had a falling out, and he actually becomes an enemy. But yeah, she does have that very strong influence on her. She also has friends. I mean, she had her Lady Beatriz de Bobadillas with her whole life. She's the daughter of the custodian of the castle where they live when she's a child. And she's with her. Beatriz de Bobadilla was at Isabel's deathbed. So all of that time, she has this friendship. And, you know, there's something always really great about when you're reading about a female character that you want to write about. If she's got girlfriends, it can't all be bad. It really can't. Usually a woman who can be keep a friendship like that with another woman, there's something there that you can work with. I'm always a little leery of the woman who doesn't have girlfriends. But, yeah, she's shaped by Carrillo. A great character.
It's a great observation about the churchmen were all, you know, warriors.
We're warriors.
Church, yeah. 1/3 of all the land, and so it was, you know, it attracted ambitious people.
Absolutely. And it really wasn't about, you know, they weren't, a lot of them weren't celibate. A lot of them weren't, I mean, when Isabella, one of the things that Isabella dealt with is that when she was getting this report back from this ecumenical council she'd set up to investigate the church, out of 3 out of 4 parishes, the priest kept an official concubine. They called them a baranga. I mean, not only kept her, but she lived with him. She kept his house. I mean, you know, there was very little sort of respect for the order of the church at that particular time. And Carrillo is not known for having a baranga, but he did have an illegitimate son that he promoted at court.
Is there anything else you can say about the youngest daughter, Catherine of Aragon, that went to marry Henry VIII and his older daughter first?
She's the most beloved child in the sense that she's the last one to leave her mother. And her mother, by the time she left Isabella had lost 2 of her children, her only son, and her eldest daughter, who she was very close to. So she clung to Catherine. She actually delayed Catherine's departure to England twice because she didn't want to let her go. The letters between Catherine and Isabella are the only letters that I was able to find between one of her children and her. We know that Juana probably wrote her letters and her other children did, but they don't exist anymore. But the letters between Catalina and Isabella, there's a whole bunch of them. Because we all know Catherine of Aragon went through hell in England before she came to the throne. And she wrote a lot of letters to her mother. And they're wonderful documents to see the esteem and the love that she holds for her mother. And likewise, what Isabella returns.
That was an interesting angle because Thomas More lost his head over Catherine of Aragon's divorce later on, and he had educated his own daughters.
Right.
So maybe there was a literary, educated woman relationship going on between them.
Yeah, there could have been to a certain extent. Thomas More is a very complex individual. Yeah, yeah.
All right, next question. Time for one or two more.
Did I understand you to say that you didn't? You made a statement, something about not knowing what Isabella looked like. Are there no portraits?
No, we do know what she looks like.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought that was...
There are portraits. The problem with portraiture from her particular period, for example, if you go to the court of Catherine de' Medici, there's a wealth of portraiture available to you. You have Clouet, who's sketching from life. He's sketching one-dimensional black and white drawings that almost look real. They look like photographs because portraiture's come very much into vogue. You know, this the era of warlords and fighting to hold your throne in your own country. It's still happening, but you're not seeing the fortified castles anymore. You're seeing pleasure palaces, and people have the time and the leisure to want to be painted, to hang their portraits on the wall. But Isabella is still dealing with a feudal world, and so the few portraits we have of her, they're very staid. They're done when she's older. We have nothing of her when she was young, except for one image from A Book of Hours, where she's sitting on a chair with unbound hair, and she's got a book in her hand. It's sort of one sort of look at her. But we don't have her images as well documented, for example, as we do Henry VIII. I mean, we all know what they look like because they were all painted. But with Isabella, it was less like that. She didn't really have the leisure. And she also didn't have that level of vanity. Wasn't something she focused in on. Catherine de Medici, on the other hand, collected portraits. And she left thousands. And most of what we have in the Louvre today is due to Catherine of Medici, due to her collecting.
Right, time for one or two more questions.
Did you get to choose the reader of your audiobook?
I get to choose it with my tutor books because it's a separate audio deal. But with Random House, the deal is built into my overall offer, so they choose them. I've been really fortunate, though, that Blackstone has wanted to do every one of my audiobooks, and they always have great narrators. The narrator for The Queen's Vow is an English actress named Rosalind Landor, and she's done a wonderful, wonderful job. But it's very hard for me to listen to my books on audio. I can't do it. It's weird, you know, to hear someone else's voice when you've lived with that character. It's jarring. But for The Tudor Secret, I did choose. I chose Steve West, this actor out of L.A., to read the book. I wanted a specific voice for Brendan, and he's done a great job.
One last question, anyone?
Got one more chance.
Great. Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
It's always great when you can actually go back into the time and try to think about it from their point of view, because so few people do that, and that's the only way we really can understand another time. Otherwise, you're just imposing on them a lot of nonsense.
Exactly.
Anyway, that's the end of another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.